Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So the withdrawal agreement bill is back in the Commons today, and pretty much as expected, they are stripping out all of the amendments that the House of Lords put in yesterday. Katie, just catch us up on this story first of all. What were some of the amendments that the Lords put in to start with?
So it's clear Boris Johnson has a huge majority in the House of Commons, which means he can do pretty much what he wants there. As of yet, even with issues like HS2, where there is some Tory division, you don't get the sense the division is to the level they would have a problem with that legislation passing if it was legislated. However, the House of Lords is a completely different matter. And we have seen the House of Lords, with the withdrawal agreement bill, try and put in various measures, some of which had been touted by the government when they were talking about the WAB before the election. Now Boris Johnson has a majority. The approach from Number 10 was ultimately to leave a lot of those promises. So things like a vote or Commons approval on the direction of the negotiations, leave that be now. They don't actually have to make those concessions. Among the things that the Lords put in to the withdrawal agreement bill was, one, if you look at the settled scheme, so how EU nationals say they're living here, there are concerns among some that there is no physical document here, it's all online. And there was an amendment which is calling for physical documents to be a part of that, whether cards or other. And one other one they were looking at was protections for child refugees. This goes down to the Alfred Dubs Amendment, which again had been promised before the general election, then put on the side. It's worth pointing out in that the government haven't said they're not going to have any protection for child refugees. What they have said is they are not going into the detail right now. They are going to come forward at a different point of a statement and give information then. But those are among the things the Lords have put back in. But today in the House of Commons, they've all been taken back out. So the question is, are we going to an extended game of ping pong between the House of Commons and the House of Lords? It seems that on this issue, I was having a conversation as part of a rival podcast, which is nowhere near as good as this podcast.
I didn't know you were on a rival podcast.
Yeah, let's brush through it, but I'm going to take the intel from it and we're going to put it out first. Stuart Wood, the Labour peer, was suggesting that this would probably be a matter ended now when it comes to the fact that if the Commons voted to put all these things back in, I got the impression that his view was there was a good chance that at this point the Lords would leave it. You know, they wouldn't go to put them back in. But on other issues in the future, perhaps more constitutional issues, where the House of Lords might deem that they are outside the remit of this government, you were going to have bigger issues in terms where the Lords just give up because the House of Commons has taken them out.
James, what's the point of having an argument about things like having a physical stamp for EU nationals here or this child refugee stuff? I mean, are they really important things to be arguing about? Why shouldn't the Commons just take them? Or is it just a matter of, we don't have to listen to you, therefore we won't?
So I think they go in, to go through them in order. So the government's argue on child refugees would be, why is it in this bill? They want this bill to be clean, it doesn't need to be in here. The argument about a physical piece of paper versus a digital document is one of those things where both sides claim that what they're proposing is the best thing for people and the least likely to lead to bureaucratic confusion in the future. Although I think anyone with knowledge of how the Home Office works might think that this is inevitably going to lead. So whatever you do is going to be...
Well, I just think digital is probably more... Yeah. Open to vulnerabilities.
Well, but then if you lose, I mean, as someone who loses pieces of paper, important pieces of paper all the time, I can also see an argument for it being digital. I think the Lords wanted to make a point that it was doing its job of scrutinising legislation. But the mood I pick up from down the other end of the corridor from the House of Lords is that they know that this is not the right issue to get into a massive fight with the government on. The government won the election on Get Brexit Done. Holding up the Brexit bill, even kind of ultimately, they would have to be prepared to risk a no deal if they really were going to keep on holding it up. It is not going to happen. But I think what this is a reminder of is that the government has no majority in the House of Lords. And I think where the Lords will feel much more able to flex its muscles are on things which were implied rather than explicit in the Tory manifesto. For example, the Tory manifesto promises this Democracy and Rights Commission, which is going to look at things like the role of the Supreme Court. I think the House of Lords would not block that being set up, because that would be against the Salisbury Convention. But I think the House of Lords will feel entitled to hold up any proposals that come out of it on the grounds that, you know, all the manifesto said was you're setting up a commission. And I think you can see in some of these arguments the laying down of the lines in the House of Lords of where these battles are going to come from.
And James, yesterday as well, all three of the devolved assemblies have decided to withhold consent for the withdrawal agreement bill, that is in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And they cite a Sewell Convention which says that the government shouldn't normally go ahead with devolved issues without the consent of devolved authorities. Is this going to be a unionist problem that's going to run and run?
I don't think that this is the precise problem, but there is obviously a challenge for the union in that Scotland voted to stay in the EU, but the UK is leaving the EU. You know, Northern Ireland voted to stay in the EU, and the UK is leaving the EU. Wales obviously voted to leave. So that, I think, is where the problem is. And I think what you will see Nicola Sturgeon argue repeatedly is that the UK leaving the EU is a material change in Scotland's circumstances and therefore justifies another independence referendum as soon as possible, rather than having to wait for this kind of a generation to expire. Now, there is now a very interesting question, which is Brexit right now is undoubtedly a problem for the union because all four parts of the union did not vote the same way in that referendum. Once Brexit happens, I think it becomes slightly different because there is a reason that the Scottish Nationalists argued for independence in Europe, because if Scotland and our UK were all going to be in the single market and the customs union, managing independence becomes much, much easier. If you end up in a situation where our UK is outside of the single market and the customs union and Scotland is attempting to be inside the single market and the customs union by applying to join the EU, that, as the Northern Irish experience shows, is inevitably going to lead to kind of friction at the border somewhere. And how do you manage that? And I think that makes the economic case for independence more difficult for the SNP, even if they might feel that their identity case, in a way, for it has been strengthened, because they turn around to people and say, "Ah, look, you know, when you voted to stay in the UK, you were told that was the best way to stay in the EU. Now the UK is leaving the EU."
And Katie, in other news today, Lisa Nandy has officially made it into the next stage of the Labour leadership contest with support from Chinese for Labour. What are her chances of actually making it through as Labour leader?
So at the moment, Lisa Nandy and Keir Starmer are through. We are expecting Rebecca Long-Bailey to make it through. The Unite endorsement is coming later this week, and we expect that to go to Long-Bailey, at which point it looks as though it's a three-horse race. There is a chance it becomes a four-horse race if Emily Thornberry manages to go through a quite difficult route of winning CLPs. I think she's on about 3 at the moment, and she needs to get to over 30. So that is uphill, but I don't think it can be ruled out completely. In terms of Lisa Nandy's pitch, is interesting. Jess Phillips has today endorsed Lisa Nandy, and I think there are quite a few people who thought Jess Phillips would move to Keir Starmer. I think that polling has suggested, and obviously all polling should be taken with a heavy pinch of salt, that Jess Phillips supporters naturally go to Keir next if you ask people who do you like. You know that. So does Jess Phillips saying go to Lisa Nandy, or she thinks Lisa Nandy's the best way forward, does that change that? Does that dent Keir Starmer's bid? Because I think there was a sense that the natural way forward would be through there. Lisa Nandy, seen by some as the person who is the happiest to talk about problems the party had in the general election and not pretend everything was brilliant. However, she gave a very interesting interview in the Today programme this morning, which I think threw quite a few people off who were perhaps drawn to her on the grounds that she did appear to be addressing difficult issues and saying there were problems in the election. In her Today programme interview, she was very supportive of Jeremy Corbyn and she was very critical of the mainstream media. It felt as though she was lurching to the left, and that might make practical sense in terms of the membership if you now you are in the membership stage of the contest, but I think for some she is appearing as that candidate who can bring together various factions, so it'd be interesting to see how she pitches. If you speak to people close to the Nandy camp, I think they view their path to her winning as all about second preference votes, so it's a preferential voting system. Once you get to the membership championship stage, members and registered supporters don't just say the person they want to win. They say they want the person they want to win, and the person they would like to win, the first person didn't. Yeah. And then if the person with the least votes is knocked out, so long as someone doesn't have a clear majority. So in theory, the Nandi argument goes that she is, as less is known about her and she is less divisive than some, she is palatable to a wider number of voters than any other candidate. So even if you have people who choose Keir Starmer first, Emily Thornberry first, Rebecca Long Bailey first, Nandi has a good chance of being their second choice. So if you have someone knocked out, it could mean that she suddenly goes ahead by quite a considerable margin. But for that to happen, she has to not be third or fourth in the membership round. So I think it's still very uphill for her, but she definitely is making the race more interesting. Mm. And I think you have to be careful, which is, I think she's getting a lot of column inches because she is, in a way, the most interesting thing about this race right now. But she is tapping into something, but yet every poll so far suggests that she is considerably far back on the membership.
I always worry about the column inches just because everyone in SW1 was so excited about Rory Stewart, and that obviously didn't work out as a lot of people were expecting. And James, in your upcoming column in The Spectator, you write that the problem with the leadership campaign at the moment is that none of them are looking to change Labour. They're not looking towards the future. They're still looking to continue whatever Corbyn had built. Do you think Lisa Nandi is falling into that trap more with that interview today and so on?
I think what's difficult, as Katie said, if you're pursuing a second preference strategy, is it becomes harder to be the truth teller because you've got a wider pool of people who can't offend. So today she was on the Labour program saying she wasn't going to trash either New Labour or Jeremy Corbyn because you're trying to thread that needle. I think the fundamental problem for Lisa Nandi is, you know, if you think about it, what took David Cameron in 2005 from someone who was only really known in Westminster to being able to win the Tory leadership contest? It was essentially that conference speech, because there was a moment when the press and the Tory membership all concentrated on the same event, watched it, and you could see the leadership contenders in direct comparison to each other. I mean, the challenge, Lisa Nandi, is, you know, yes, there are some televised debates in this contest, but what is the equivalent moment to that? Because, you know, On name recognition, she is badly lagging behind at the moment. And the ballots go out next month. And although the contest isn't over until April, we know that a very large number of people, when they get a postal vote, return it pretty much straight away. So she needs some moment where she can kind of grab attention and make her case. I think, though, that, you know, one of the things, a kind of surprising fact about British politics, is in the last 40 years, only two leaders of the opposition have become Prime Minister, Tony Blair and David Cameron. And they were both elected on an explicit, this party needs to change if it's going to win, but by parties that were desperate enough for power at that point to completely accept that argument. I don't think the Labour Party is in that place yet. I think a Labour Party that was desperate for power wouldn't regard Jeremy Corbyn and Ed Miliband as the two best leaders of the last 100 years. You know, I think that Labour haven't yet got to that point of being like, right, we really want to win again, so tell us what we need to do.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And you can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, through all the usual routes, and why not tell a friend about it? And if you'd like to come along to our Spectator event on the 25th of February, Fraser Nelson and Kate Andrews are going to be debating with David Goodhart about whether or not it's now time to give illegal immigrants amnesty. To find tickets, go to spectator.co.uk/amnestypodcast. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.